Now tonight I have three references that I'll be turning to in the message of the evening. Our subject, a rather unusual subject, forward march. It might be well now to go with Israel for one day as they had the tabernacle in their midst, of how they marched on the wilderness march, how they would take it down, how they would put it up again. Because you will remember, it's a temporary structure. It's called a tent, skene, just a flimsy tent is all that it was. And it could be taken down, I imagine, in a matter of really minutes, because these men became expert in taking it down and putting it up, I'm sure. Now, as we begin this, I'd like to turn first to the 40th chapter of Exodus, and I'll read verses 20 and 21. And we're looking in particular first here at the ark, because it was the very heart of the entire camp, the very center of it. And sometimes the tabernacle itself was just called the house or the tent of the ark. It was the place where it dwelt. I'm reading, "He took and put the testimony into the ark," that is the Ten Commandments. "He set the staves on the ark," and these staves meant it was to be carried on the shoulders, "and he put the mercy seat above upon the ark, and he brought the ark into the tabernacle, and he set up the veil of the covering and covered the ark of the testimony as the Lord commanded Moses." Now, particular attention is given to it. And then when you come over to the fourth chapter of the book of Numbers, and I'd like for you to notice the fourth chapter of the book of Numbers, this gets before us the first thing that happened when they began the wilderness march. Now, this is what would happen. In Numbers 4, 5, and 6, "And when the camp setteth forward, Aaron shall come and his sons, and they shall take down the covering veil and cover the ark of testimony with it." In other words, the first thing that happened before they began the wilderness march, Aaron had to come in, take down the veil, and drop it over the ark and the mercy seat. "And he shall put thereon the covering of badger skins, shall spread over it a cloth wholly of blue, and shall put in the staves thereof." Now the staves went in all the articles of furniture because they were carried on the shoulders of the priests through the wilderness. That was the way the ark went through. God gave wagons to some of the other families to carry what they carried, but he gave nothing to the family of Kohath that carried the articles of furniture. They carried it on their shoulder. All of these articles, as we've seen, speak of Christ. Through the wilderness, Christ was carried on the shoulders of his priests. I've often thought that the Lord could really eliminate a great deal of effort and a great deal of, shall I say, agony in prayer today, if he would give out the gospel himself and not depend on us to give it out. If he would flash it on the sky some Sunday morning, I thought this summer, beaches, probably a million people on the beaches from Santa Monica down to San Diego. God could write it in the sky. And if I were the Lord, that's the way I'd do it. And I would really let them have it. That is, if I was in that position. Why didn't he do that? May I say to you that the articles of furniture had to be carried on the shoulders of priests. And today it's his plan and purpose that the gospel be carried on the shoulders of those that are priests, that is, of believers. God has no other method of getting out his word today except through those that are his own. And that's a very good statement to begin a missionary conference, by the way. That's a proper statement to begin a missionary conference, because God has no other method of getting out his word. Now, he could flash it in the sky, and I'd recommend that to him. He could really get attention. Well, he won't do that. I used to think, boy, these Kohathites, what a job they had. Everybody else had a wagon. Why didn't the Kohathites say, "Moses, Can we have wagons too? Why put the staves in there and we have to grunt and lift it up and with great effort? You remember Paul said something to the Colossians? A remarkable statement. I preached on it here already several times because it's such a remarkable statement. Paul said that it's necessary for me to suffer to get the gospel out. And you immediately say, you mean to tell me, Paul, that Christ's sufferings was not enough? The fact of the matter is, no, not enough. Dr. George Gill used to put it like this. He said the reason that people do not get born again today any more than they do is because there are not enough Christians who are willing to travail, because nothing can be born without travail. And that's the problem today. No one's willing to travail. If you're going to get the gospel out today, brother, you've got to get that shoulder underneath to carry. And I want to tell you, that's no easy task. That was God's method. Now, that's important to see here at the beginning. Now, and when Aaron, verse 15, and when Aaron and his sons, maybe I didn't read that last verse 4, this shall be the service of the sons of Kohath in the tabernacle of the congregation about the most holy things. And when the camp setteth forth, Aaron shall come and his sons, and they shall take down the covering veil and cover the ark of the testimony with it. They shall put thereon the covering of badger skin, shall spread over it a cloth holy of blue. They shall put in the staves thereof. And then when they did that, they said, come on, Kohathites, get your shoulder in under it. It was done in relays. These fellows, they would carry it probably for an hour. Then there'd be another shift. They'd take it up. It was a large family. But they are carrying the ark, if you please. Now, verse 15. And when Aaron and his sons shall make an end of covering the sanctuary and all the vessels of the sanctuary, as the camp is to set forward, after that the sons of Kohath shall come to bear it, for they shall not touch any holy thing lest they die. These things are the burden of the sons of Kohath in the tabernacle of the congregation. These things are the burden. It was a burden. Word of God doesn't say it's not a burden. I hear it said today, it costs so much to get the gospel out today. It costs so much to send out missionaries. Sure it does. God never intended for it to be cheap. It's a costly proposition. And I think we forget that. We emphasize so much that the gospel is free, and it is, and that all you have to do is to accept it. But I always think of the Negro preacher. He preached the gospel of the grace of God. And then one morning he got up and he urged his congregation to give. He said, we need money. We need money. A deacon got up in the back and he said, Mr. Preacher, you've been saying that the gospel is for nothing. You've been saying that the water of life is free. The preacher got up and he said, that's right. The water of life is free. But it costs something to pipe it to you. And my friend, it costs something today to pipe it. To get it out, it does cost. And we need to keep that in mind. Now, I've read this concerning the ark, because that was the beginning of any movement. Until that ark was covered by Aaron, until the veil went over it and was wrapped up, nothing happened. That camp couldn't move an inch until that took place. That ark is Christ. The ark is Christ. He's the leader. Till he moves, we ought not to move. That is the ark in the tabernacle. Now I want to bring this down here and get it before us again. This is your last opportunity to see these lovely charts that we have now for a long time. Because I'm not teaching this again for 18 years. And I'll be back to it in 18 years. But I'll be in heaven then. Now will you notice, we have here these different articles of furniture. We've looked at them. We're not going over it again. But here is where the action was, shall we say, in the Holy of Holies. Now here, the ark has been put in the center. And I think the reason that the artist here put it in the center was because he didn't know where it went. and you're safe if you put it in the center. Now, there have been those that put it over here in the back. I do not think it belongs there. I think it belonged right here by the veil for two reasons. One reason is that as far as God's order is concerned, they were to face the east, the sun rising. They were to face, that spoke to them of opportunity, a new day, and all that sort of thing. So that I believe that when the high priest went in, he turned around to face east. Otherwise, he'd be facing west. Somebody said to me, maybe, you're splitting hairs yourself. Maybe I am. But there's another reason for it. You see, when Aaron came in, this ark was right next to the veil, you see. It was on the east side, not on the west side. Because he got up and loosened the veil, and when he did, he dropped it down over the ark and the mercy seat. And then when he dropped it down over, he just wrapped it around, he tied it. Then there was given to him one of the badger skins that went over the outside of the ark. He put that around it, and then this blue covering was put over it, and then the Kohathites were called in, and they took that out. And the minute that the ark moved out, the people knew that they were to march that day. And then the rest of the tabernacle was taken down. Now let's see that maybe a little bit more in detail here with what we have tonight. These boards and bars had to be taken down. We'll see about that. And also the capitals on top. And then this that actually was the foundation. And these were, of course, solid silver and solid brass. Here was where the veil was attached. And then all of these coverings, like the linen coverings, the four coverings here, and there were many other coverings, they were all taken and folded and wrapped up, and they were given to certain ones to carry. We'll see that in a moment. But all I want you to do is to see the structure and the problem they had. All of these, they took staves out here, and when they did, they just lifted these boards out of their sockets. And then each one knew whether he's to carry board number 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, whether he's to carry socket 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, so that every one of the Levites knew exactly what he was to do on the wilderness march. And the minute that the ark and the mercy seat was pulled out of the tabernacle, the structure was taken down, and it was taken down immediately. Now here is a picture of the ark itself, the mercy seat that covered it, and you can see it's quite an imposing article. Remember, this was solid gold. It was overlaid with gold, acacia wood. It was heavy wood. The staves put in there. And apparently, there was a whole crew of Kohathites that carried it. And as we said, they worked in shifts. Now they are to leave Mount Sinai. They've come out of Egypt. They've come down to Mount Sinai here. And they are to leave Mount Sinai with the tabernacle. And they had to march up in order, and they're going first, of course, to Kadesh Barnea, which is really 11 days' journey, but they're going to waste 40 years in this wilderness. There were 2 years getting here, 38 years from here on in. But sometimes they'd spend a day in a place, sometimes they'd spend a month, sometimes they'd spend a year. And in some places, they spent as much as 2 years. And, of course, the tabernacle was not taken down or put up in that period. But every time the people were to move, then they took it down. Now, I want you to see this. This is the way the tribes camped around. We have here the tabernacle. And when they came into camp at night, they came in and camped in this order. And you'll see in a few moments why they camped in this order. The tribe of Judah led and was apparently in the center here rather than up here. The tribe of Judah took center, a front. And Aaron and Moses were immediately in front of the tabernacle. They stopped here. And the two tribes, Issachar and Zebulun, under the standard of Judah, and that standard was a lion, they all came into position. They all knew their place. And to the south, there came the tribe of Reuben, two tribes with him, Gad and Simeon. And to the north, there came the tribe of Dan, and Asher and Naphtali was with them. Here in the back was Ephraim with Manasseh and Benjamin. And by the way, I should say that you have here the ox, and you have here the man, and you have here the man, and you have up here the eagle. Four standards. And I want to give that in just a moment. But now immediately around the tabernacle, the three families of the Levites camped. There was the family, of course, of Aaron. They were the priestly, high priestly family. They were here with Moses. He belonged to that family, and they were really Kohathites. But the Kohathites carried all the articles of furniture. They were on the south. And the Gershonites, they carried all of the curtains and coverings of the tabernacle. They were in the rear, but that is the back of the tabernacle. The Merariites are the family of Merari. They are the ones that carried the boards, the bars. Their name means bitterness. They had the heavy work to do, by the way, of carrying those boards and bars and solid brass sockets, solid silver sockets, and there were many of them. And tent pins they had to take out of the sand every time they marched and drive them back in when they camped. And we'll see that in a moment. Now, this is the way the camp of Israel marched. That is, I should say, the way they came into camp. Now, I want us to see how they marched. By the way, I should put this up. Judah the lion, Reuben the man, Dan the eagle, and Ephraim the ox. That is interesting. Don't make too much of it. Some people try to read it into the stars. That's nonsense. We're not superstitious or being pagan. You don't do that. And this, by the way, is merely tradition. Kyle and Delitzsch, in their very fine, helpful commentary, they speak of these. These were called deglas. The deglas in the Greek, they were the standards. And there were four of those standards. Actually, each tribe had a standard. But these four standards were the ones that they marched in under. Every man had to find his place under his standard. And they give the name Degla. And this is tradition. There's no Bible for this right here, that the lion eagle. But that does come down to us. And there's the scripture for it. We know that Jacob's prophecy to Judah was about the lion, Reuben about the man, and so on. Now, will you notice, we want to see them get on the march now. Let me put this back. They're in camp. We're going with them one day. Let's see what happens. Now, in the book of Numbers, and I've been going over that again, I love the book of Numbers. I wish it people thought it was more interesting. I'd love to teach it. I think it's one of the most interesting books in the Bible. I know of no book that has the practical lessons for us like the book of Numbers. Now, the children of Israel, when they're camped around here, certain things have happened. They arrive there at the 19th chapter of the book of Exodus. All of the rest of the book of Exodus was given, all the book of Leviticus, and 10 chapters in the book of Numbers. What's God doing? He's giving them the law, the whole Mosaic system, including this tabernacle and the details of it, a place of worship. He's preparing them for the wilderness march. And there were certain things that had to be established. Each man had to declare his pedigree, had to tell who he was. Suppose when they were taking the pedigree, a man steps up. There are those that were representative of each tribe there. Step up and he'd say to him, "Are you an Israelite?" "Well," he says, "no, I hope I am. I try to be an Israelite. I've joined the Israelites. I just hope I am." What do you think they would have done with him? They'd pitched him out of the camp. Because nobody was there by hope so or trying to be an Israelite. You were born an Israelite and you had to know it. May I say to you, you have to be a born again child of God and you need to know it. We ought to know. And not only know who you are, but you know where you belong. Can you imagine one of them wandering around in the camp and Moses said, "Where you belong, brother?" "I don't know where I belong." "Are you a member of the tribe of Judah?" "Well, now I think I'm a member of the tribe of Judah." He not only had to know who he was, he had to know where he belonged. Because each one of these tribes had their place, and each tribe in its particular spot, and each family in that tribe had a certain place where they camped every night that they camped. It was right there. They had an address. You could find them. No, they never went through that wilderness as a mob. They were the most highly organized group that you've ever heard of. And each one had his place. He had to know who he was. He had to know where he belonged. And you know what else he had to know? What he was to do. Every man had his job. And what happened of a morning? They got up. And the pillar of fire had been there all night. At sunup, it changed to the pillar of cloud. And Moses and Aaron got out. And maybe somebody from the tribe of Judah, they were close by, came up and said, "Moses, we're going to march today?" Moses never said, "Well, I haven't decided yet." Moses said, "I'm just waiting for instruction." He's waiting. Now, if the cloud lifted, they marched. If the cloud didn't lift, they didn't march. Now, this day we follow them. Moses and Aaron are there talking it over. And the cloud lifts. What happens? We've already read it. Aaron goes in immediately into the tabernacle. Nobody moves till he goes into the tabernacle. He goes up there and he lets down the veil. It covers the ark. It covers the mercy seat. And he wraps it. He takes the badger skin. He wraps it. Puts the blue covering on it. He comes out and he says, "Come get it, boys." And the Kohathites come rushing in. They put it on their shoulder. They go out, and while the rest of it is coming down, that ark moves through the camp of Judah and goes way up yonder, because that ark's going to lead on the wilderness march with a pillar of clouds over it. And it'll lead on the wilderness march. They were a God-led group of people. Now, somebody says they had no choices to make. They sure did. They're led of God, but they also have free will. And in Kadesh Barnea, they're going to turn and go back. But will God go on in and leave them? No, sir. He go with them. He told them, he said, "I'm with you." They killed 38 years in that wilderness. And God let you do that, and he let me do that. You talk about free will, God let you exercise. If you want to piddle around as a Christian, he let you piddle around. And a lot of folks today, not this crowd, but there are a lot of them, they're not here tonight. They piddle around today. They piddle around. And somebody said, "Well, why doesn't God do something about it?" He doesn't. He piddles around with them. Yes, he does. He piddles around with them. But my friend, you're wasting a lot of time. And they wasted a lot of time in that wilderness. Now, the pillar of fire has gone out, and the pillar of cloud takes over. And now the ark moves out, and the pillar is there. They're ready to march, but he's not going ahead. The rest of the tabernacle has to come down. And they begin to take down the rest of the tabernacle. After all the articles of furniture are taken out, the Kohathites take them. Now they move out, and by the time they move out, Judah's going to move forward. We'll see that in a minute. Judah and Issachar and Zebulun, they move out. Then the Kohathites will move out. And then we'll find out that the south will move out. Reuben will move out, and those under him. You see, while they were taking down the tabernacle, all of the families were packing their goods. They were getting ready to march. And the whole camp is going forward. Now, way on the outside of the camp are the flocks and the herds kept by the shepherds. And they see what's happening, and they begin to move the flocks and herds forward. It was a well-organized group, probably the best organized of anything that you can imagine. Now I'm turning to the 10th chapter, and let's watch this movement, and then we'll come back to this again, and we'll see them as they're out on the march. Verse 11, "It came to pass on the 20th day of the second month in the second year that the cloud was taken up from off the tabernacle of the testimony, and the children of Israel took their journeys out of the wilderness of Sinai, and the cloud rested in the wilderness of Paran. And they first took their journeys according to the commandment of the Lord by the hand of Moses. First place went the standard of the camp of the children of Judah according to their armies." Now, I want to make reference to these, and let me put them up here. And I'll have to use two in order to get them all on the march. I'll have to put two of these up. We'll put this first, and we'll see them move out. On the wilderness march, the ark came out of the tabernacle and went way up to lead. Then Moses and Aaron followed. This was where the leadership was. Then Judah, here, as we've read here in verse 14, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun, they moved out. That's not very good writing, is it? But I hope you can read it. Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. Now, will you notice, we come on down. Verse 17 is Gershon and Merari. Now, Gershon is carrying all of the curtains and coverings, and Merari is carrying all the heavy stuff. Let's read that. Verse 17 now. We're on the march. And the tabernacle was taken down, and the sons of Gershon, the sons of Merari, set forward bearing the tabernacle. Now, they carried the rest of the tabernacle, and it fitted in right here. Now you have Reuben coming up next. Verse 18. Let me read that. And the standard of the camp of Reuben set forward according to their armies, and over his host was Eleazar, the son of Shedeur. And then under that are those that are with him. Not read all that. Now will you notice, they come next. Then you have Kohath coming next. Kohath, verse 21. Now you see, they're carrying the rest of the articles of furniture. You see, they took down the tabernacle, they got all this out of the way, then the other articles were left there. So they just took them up, the Kohathites did, and carried them. The ark has already been taken up front. Now let's read that. Verse 21. And the Kohathites set forward, bearing the sanctuary, and the other did set up the tabernacle, against they came. Now do you see why? You talk about order. This is terrific. Here is Kohath here, Gershon here, and a whole three tribes in between them. So when they came into camp, you know what happened first? The ark came to rest. Everything's put around the ark. And then these fellas come up. They've got the tabernacle, if you please. They've got the curtains and coverings, the boards and the bars, the sockets. They bring it up and put it all around the ark, right where it belongs. It's put up right around the ark. Now, by the time Reuben, Simeon, Gad get into their place to the south, Kohathites just move up. By that time, the tabernacle is up. They just put the articles of furniture where they belong, then they move out. You talk about order. You couldn't have anything any more orderly than that, you see. When they take it down the next day, what happens? They take down the tabernacle and the other articles of furniture left there. The Kohathites move in, pick it up, move out. Can you think of anything done better than that? I can remember when I was a pastor in Nashville, Tennessee. Maybe I ought not tell this, but we used to do this. You remember when Ringling Brothers and Barnum and Bailey used to travel by railroad car and put up the big tent? We used to get up. I had some young deacons at that time, and we made a ball of it. That night that the circus came to town before they set up for the next day, why, we didn't go to bed that night. We just went to one home, and we had coffee, had a late lunch. About 2 o'clock in the morning, we go down to railroad yards and wait. And it was about 2 o'clock, why, you would hear the whistle, and that old steam engine you'd see way down in the railroad yards, the circus has come to town. And they'd pull in, and they'd put them on two side tracks. They'd run all the flat cars in, then they'd run in all the animal cages. It was interesting how they do it. When they ran in those flat cars with all of the tents on it, immediately all those trucks were on the flat cars. They ran them off and they headed out for the circus ground. And when we stayed there and we watched them, and it was amazing to watch how they did, when that thing first stopped, you would think there was nobody in that circus. Then all of a sudden they'd start rolling out from underneath those wagons. This fellow's been sleeping there. And they have that thing moving. I would say in 10 minutes after those cars came to rest on the sidetracks, that circus was moving out to the circus ground at about 2 o'clock in the morning. And so we'd stay there. Then you'd see them. They'd begin to move the animal cages. Then they'd begin to move the equipment that used in the tent. Everything, see, was in place. Everybody seemed to know what they were doing. And then those that were the performers, they were the ones that came out last. That was about daylight. Then they would come out. When they did, we got in a car and headed out for the circus ground. By that time, the kitchen tent has gone up. The crew is already putting up the big tent. By that time, the animal tent, you know, the one you go in first, it's up. The animal cages have been put in place. They all eat there. And we got acquainted with him. We got acquainted with Frank Buck when he had the animal section. And they'd invite us in to have coffee. We'd go in and sit down and drink coffee with them. And then after they had their breakfast, they're back out there. And do you know, by 10 o'clock in the morning, that whole circus is up. It's a city in and of itself. They're feeding the animals, watering the elephants. Everything's in place. And I used to tell my deacons, I said, you know, this is exciting as to watch the children of Israel come into camp. I said, they would have done it the same way. They'd have been as, imagine, there are at least 2.5 millions of people with them, and they are orderly. Every man knows his place. Everybody knows what he's to do, and he does it. You know what's wrong with the church today? Can you see that picture? Church doesn't move like that, does it? To begin with, they don't know who they are. Second place, they don't know where they belong. In the third place, they don't know what they're to do. And my friend, when you can't answer any of those questions today, you're in a bad way as a believer, I'll tell you that. And that's the reason we're having the frustration we have and the bogging down in the church today, is because we have folk in the church who cannot answer those three questions. Now, will you notice, we're not through. We haven't got them all here. They did it faster than I'm doing it, I'll tell you that. Now, will you notice here, we have the sixth, and I should call your attention to this because this is very meaningful. Here's number one, division one, division two, division three, division four, division five, division six coming up. Ephraim was next, and Dan was next. I won't read it. You can read it there, verse 22 and 25. 6 and 7. Isn't that interesting? You have the blowing of 7 trumpets. Because on the wilderness march, verse 5, when ye blow an alarm, then the camps that lie on the east part shall go forward. When ye blow an alarm the second time, then the camps lie on the south. Every time a group moves out, a trumpet's blown, and when they blow them 7 times, you've arrived. They're moving. Now, when anyone doesn't know this, and they come to the book of Revelation, no wonder the amillennialist tries to tie the 7 trumpets into the trump, the last trump for the church. There's no connection at all, because we're told here in chapter 10, verse 4, and if they blow but with 1 trumpet, then the princes, which are heads of the thousands of Israel, shall gather themselves unto thee. In other words, when 1 trumpet is blown, that's the last for the princes. They come together. That is the one that takes the church out of the world. For the Lord himself shall descend from heaven with a shout, the voice of the archangel, the trump of God. The dead in Christ shall rise first, caught up to meet the Lord in the air. And the 7 trumpets that moves them on the wilderness march are the blowing of the 2 silver trumpets, and it hasn't anything in the world to do with the last trump for the church at all. There's no connection at all. What does this do? What does the 7 trumpets in Revelation do? They get the children of Israel back in that land, if you please. That is the thing that happens. You have a movement of judgment at the blowing of the 1st trumpet, the 2nd, the 3rd, the 4th, 5th, 6th, and 7th. They're an alarm. Alarm for this world of what's coming upon it. And at that 7th trumpet, he returns to the earth. He brings them back into that land. May I say to you, that's the blowing of the 7 trumpets. That's the way God, for 40 years, moved them through the wilderness. Now, I want to notice something. I'll not take time tonight. Talk about that mixed multitude. There were the troublemakers. They're not numbered. They don't belong to it. They were mixed multitude. We don't know how many there were. There may have been a great many. They probably were not too many. But you don't have to have many to be troublemakers. Remember the farmer's wife said, please drain that pond. The frogs at night, they keep me awake. They croak. There must be thousands of them in that pond. Poor farmer's wife kept after him. He drained the pond. There were 2 frogs in it. 2 frogs can really do a lot of croaking. And I don't know how many. We're in a mixed multitude. We're told the numbers of the other tribe, but you don't count this number because they don't count. And they're the ones that caused all the trouble. And the reason was this, mixed multitude. An Israelite would marry an Egyptian woman. An Egyptian man would marry an Israelite. They have an offspring. He's half Egyptian, half Israelite. And when Moses said to them that night, be ready to march, I can see a family like that. One of the boys says, I don't think I'm going. After all, I'm Egyptian. The other boy says, yeah, but I'm half Israelite. I think I ought to go. And he goes. But they never were sure. They never were sure they should have left Egypt. In fact, that's the crowd that said, you remember when the trouble started, the mixed multitude fell to lusting. They said, we remember the leeks, the onions, and the garlic, and the fish that we ate in the land of Egypt. Boy, they never forgot Egypt. They were half Egyptian. They never knew. You have to know who you are and where you belong. They knew nothing. A lot of folk like that in the church today. And may I say again, that's where the trouble is. Now, the thing I want you to notice is this, because I think this is important for us tonight. I think it's very important for believers. A great many people think today, well, you know, there's not very much I can do, and I don't do very much, and I don't count very much in God's program. I do not know who you are, but if you're God's child tonight, you count as much as Billy Graham counts in his program. I can assure you that. You're just as important to God, and what you do is just as important as what he does. And all he's asking of you is that you be faithful, and that's all he's asked of Billy Graham. He just gave him a greater responsibility. And if Billy Graham is not faithful, and you are, you'll get a bigger reward than he'll ever get. Now, don't misunderstand what I'm saying. I'm not saying, don't anybody go out here and say, I'm saying Billy Graham's unfaithful. He's not. What I'm saying is I'm trying to make a contrast to say, if that were true and you were faithful, then you would get a greater reward. Now, will you look at my illustration? I can well understand that after 38 years in that wilderness, there was a man in that group. You know what his job was? His job was to carry that little socket right there. For 38 years, he carried that socket. And I can well understand that one morning, he gets up, he sees the cloud lift. He doesn't feel good. He's got a dark brown taste in his mouth. He said, you know, for 38 years I've carried that little old piece of brass there. And I haven't missed a day. I've been faithful. And you know Moses has never recognized me. Aaron has never come by and patted me on the back and said, brother, you're doing a good job. And they've never had a banquet to recognize my faithfulness, and I've done it for 38 years. This morning, I'm sleeping in. I'm not going to care. If Moses wants somebody to carry that little old piece of brass, he can get somebody to carry it. I'm not carrying it. I'm through. I quit. Suppose that he does. He leaves it there. They marched during the day. I don't know how far they got. 10, 15, 20 miles. The ark's in place. Here come the Merariites, the Gershonites. They all put up. And finally, a fella here, he's holding up that side. And he's holding up the other side because that's a very important. You don't know how important that socket is until you miss it. And he's holding it up over here. And they said, where in the world is Jacob that was carrying that socket? What happened to him? I said, I think he's way back yonder today. I noticed that he's been loafing. So Aaron calls him up, says, Jacob, where's the socket? He says, right back there where we camped last night. Well, they said, that was your job to carry that. Yes, that was my job. Well, why didn't you carry it? Well, I got tired of carrying it. And Moses never recognized me, and Brother Aaron, you never patted me on the back. And I've been faithful. And I decided I'm through. I'm not going to carry it anymore. Do you know that there'd have to be somebody there all night long holding up both sides of that tabernacle because that fellow didn't bring that socket? You know what's the matter at the church today? That's the problem. Oh, there are a lot of people. No, I'm not going to do anything. I'm not going to teach a Sunday school class. I'm not going to sing in the choir. I'm not going to do these things because I'll do as I please. My friend, if you're a child of God, you don't do as you please.
You do as he pleases. You're not his child.
And when the man leaves that little socket back yonder, he holds up the entire camp. And I'm of the opinion that they camped there for a couple days, because it took one day to go back and get it, took another day to bring it up. They actually lost 3 days right here because Jacob just decided that it wasn't important for him to carry that socket. He didn't realize how important it is. And I say, if you're God's child tonight, you know you're a child of God through faith in Christ. You know where you belong, and you know what you're to do. Why don't you do it? Huh? Why don't you do it? You see, you hold up everything when you don't do what God has called you to do. Who's to determine what's important and what's not important? Who is to decide that? Only God will decide that. I'll be honest with you. The fellow that was carrying that little socket right there could well have been Vernon McGee, because I'm confident after 38 years, I'd have said, boy, they don't need me to carry that little socket. It's pretty unimportant whether I teach in the Sunday school. It's pretty unimportant whether I help the church, whether I sing in the choir, whether I do what I'm asked to do. They don't need my support of missionaries. They don't need me. I don't know about who they are that don't need you, but I do know this. God, if he saved you, he has a place for you, and he has something for you to do. And if you don't do it, it won't be done, because there's nobody else to do it. What God has called you to do.